You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our second week discussing Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down, this wonderful Argentine elevator-related mystery, a genre I never really thought we'd get into, Herds.
I mean, it does make me wonder just how many elevator-focused mysteries there are and, you know, what the scene's like. You know, do they have competitions to see who can have the biggest elevator involved?
There must be.
You know, there must be. Yeah.
We are discussing chapters 4-6 today. And it is a pretty, I feel like concise is the wrong word to use, but there's not a lot that goes on here so much as that there's a lot of curiosity that Maria Angelica Bosco kind of brings up in the space of not much action
taking place. You say that, but there is a murder, even though it is entirely off screen and honestly a little bit baffling to me, but that's okay. We'll get into that later. Like there's things that occur. There's some photographs that go missing. There's the murder of Serbo, who is the brother of a girl named Rita, who has a hard time talking to anybody because he's just an awful, awful man. There is quite a fun scene actually with the Inara family where they're trying to question, Beatriz, who is Senorita Inara, the mother there. And the lights go out and they're like, oh, that silly machine's on the fritz again. And it's very clear that the father has like jiggered his machine to cause a power outage or something, which is pretty great.
Yeah.
Like there's lots of little touches and moments to go, oh, isn't that like a fun thing? But you're right. There is no, you know, I better run and get the hound and snoop for clues. Although there is a hound. We do have Muck still.
Well, it's true. Like, I was kind of sad how much of a backseat Muck takes in this place. Because
it is a bit of a sad thing, isn't it?
Muck, in one way, sets the tone for this stretch of chapters where they're kind of lighthearted whilst dealing with relatively serious subject matter.
Yeah.
Our detective, basically, Blasi, goes around and is like, oh, yeah, you know, I just wanted to kind of get this, like, photograph processed with one of the suspects of this investigation.
There's not a lot of actual tension between the suspects and each other.
Yeah.
Or at least from what we can see, right? The truth may be a different matter. But, like, there's not a lot of tension between the suspects and the police or the police and the detective. Everyone's just kind of on more or less friendly terms.
We were also talking a little bit last time about how Ericourt and Blasi are two detective characters, kind of indistinguishable as who is the Sherlock and Watson of the pair.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm big on that, though. I kind of miss having very clear, you know, defining traits between the Sherlock and Watson, I suppose.
Yeah, the interesting thing here, though, is that Blasi very much, like, fills the Watson role.
Sure.
But he's also the one doing all of the investigation in this stretch. Ericourt basically is presented information and does a few interrogations with characters, but all of the actual running around on the scene is done by Blasi, which feels like a slightly less broad depiction of the same relationship that, say, Nero Wolfe's Archie Goodwin had.
Why would you bring them up? Nero Wolfe was never nearly assassinated while reading a newspaper. That'd be ridiculous. It seems like we always come back to those two. They may just be the greatest.
It's because they're great.
Yeah, anyway, I mean, that's a good example of a pair of detectives and sidekicks who have such a wide gap between the two of them that they stick out really, really well. You know, since the detectives are more or less similar, we do get a bit more time to kind of get invested in the rest of the cast. I think Betty in particular, who is kind of one of the more suspicious characters by the end of chapter 6, even though she seems to be falling into the, like, you know, I'm the young girl who's in way over her head and probably isn't guilty of anything, but she ends up just like doing all these suspicious things and clearly like has, you know, probably romantic secrets or that sort of thing, which I think is quite interesting.
Well, yeah, and the other thing that we haven't really done so far is like recapped what's happened.
Sure,
and that's
sure.
Because, as you kind of touch on there, most of what happens here is just the interrogation stretch. We just kind of go from character to character, except instead of bringing them all into a room one after the other and talking to them about what happened, we're visiting them day after day, you know, asking them about photographs, going out to a cafe with them.
Digging through trash.
There's a really interesting scene where we go back to the Eidinger's house and we discover,
oh my goodness,
Gabby is there like hiding up in the roof because Eidinger didn't want her to be found at his house because he thought it would look too suspicious to the police.
Mm-hmm, that's the one. She's just hiding there. It's totally fine.
Yeah.
Am I mixing up Gabby and Betty, or are they the same character?
It's Betty at Eidinger's house. So I should correct myself.
That's what I thought. Okay, I'm glad that we double checked that because I was worried that I had ruined all of my theories.
Yeah, but our allocation of character time in this stretch is also really bizarre to me. I don't know if you kind of felt the same about this. For example, Dr. Lukta, when he shows up while Blasi is having drinks in a cafe with one of the other suspects, says, "Oh, I recognized you from behind as I entered." And it's like, oh, did you now, Lukta?
He seems so suspicious.
You want to flesh that out for me a little bit?
He's too suspicious. He is like, he clearly knows a lot, but like he's just like, he's a kind doctor, man, hopefully. Except for that time when he offers the cigarette, as you mentioned, you know, before we got in the booth here, where he offers the cigarette after a poisoning has just taken place to one of the cops.
Two poisonings.
And he's like, "Why don't you just have a cigarette that I'm going to offer you for my personal stash?" And the policeman is like, I'll just, sure. I don't see anything wrong with this. This seems
fine. The other one with Solaire and Lukta that I really loved is in chapter 6 when Solaire is like, sitting in a room, and for some reason Maria Angelica Bosco just puts this in his head and says like, "When one does not know what to think, one speaks." It's that so is common sense.
I mean, that's such
one makes love, or failing that, one drinks anything to stop oneself sinking into the bottomless and torturous pit of thought.
I need to tell you, that's like my favorite little like mini monologue of this entire story. It puts you so well in his mindset.
So out of place in a way that I genuinely loved.
It's so good. It just shows how like he's on a completely different wavelength from everyone there, just being like, I need to look out for number one, and I need to make sure that there's all like, I don't have time to think. Like, if I think about things too hard, I'll start to get guilty of my own actions. Like, there's a lot implied through the way that he perceives himself and, like, the way that he has to fill the void of self-reflection with something to distract himself.
Well, yeah, that was the thing that I wanted to kind of drag us back to. Is at the beginning, I said it kind of felt like Muck set the tone for this chapter, even though he's not actually present in most of the scenes that we go through. And that's because this feels so much like we as an audience are the like Watson puppy dog following Blasi around.
We are the Muck.
It's such a strange feeling. And I don't know if Maria Angelica Bosco intended Muck as the like tone setter for that for me. But for some reason, it just kind of clicked with me and I really enjoyed it.
It's one of those things where in stories, right, when you're constructing as an author or a designer or whatever, you're constructing like the cast of characters. They'll come up with like the lowest bar of like maturity or of innocence or whatever that could accept this kind of story, right? Mm. And I feel the same about Muck. I feel that Muck is here to say like, there is murder in this story, but like we're not going to be ripping people open or like seeing grisly holes in people's heads or anything like that. And I imagine the resolution isn't going to be like a big chase scene and lots of fighting because Muck's there. Muck needs to be able to keep up with the action. He's plodding along. He needs to be able to keep up with what everybody else is doing. So
that's why Knox's rule number 9, the stupid friend of the detective, the Watson must not conceal any thoughts which pass through his head, and his intelligence must be slightly, but very slightly below that of the average reader.
Because he's the bar.
And some could argue that you could apply the same description to a dog.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And he's the bar. The Watson is the bar. Although in this case, the story, Muck is the bar for like, if you are as intelligent as this poor little doggy, you can handle whatever this story throws at you, which I think is really beautiful.
And we like never see explicitly through Muck's eyes, but it just feels like it a little bit, you know? Yeah,
it's beautiful.
Yeah, I suppose we should probably push over to the mystery section towards the end of this show, Herds.
Yeah, dude, we should.
I'm very excited to hear your solution for this because the ending to this book has taken me more read-throughs than anything that we've covered this entire year to quite fully grasp it. So I hope you're on the ball.
I need to let you know, I have some things that I'm like, well, this is obvious, but I'm going to be making so many stabs in the dark, and hopefully you can pull the answers from deep within my brain hole, because I sure as heck can't sort them out myself. This is a challenge is what this is. this is a lot for me.
Alrighty, you're listening to Death of the Reader. We are discussing Death Going Down by Maria Angelica Bosco, and we'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex here with you, and I'm about to play for you an interview that happened quite some months ago. Fresh off the heels of reading a stretch of Japanese and metafictional murder mystery novels, the news was put out that a translation of Seishi Yokomizo's Village of Eight Graves, translated by Brian Karatnik, would be coming out in early December this year. And I sat down with those thoughts fresh on my mind to talk with Brian about translation. And I figured now that we are getting into translation again with Maria Angelica Bosco, it'd be the perfect time to bring it to you. The book comes out on the 2nd of December. We'll have links up on the podcast if you're interested in getting yourself a copy. I'm very excited to get my hands on it after enjoying the Honjin murder case so much when it was put out. So here is that discussion with translator Brian Karatnik. Brian, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Let's start with the icebreaker question. I know you've done several classic translations, both Russian and Japanese, for Pushkin in the past. How did you end up with the task of translating The Village of Eight Graves?
It's an interesting one, really. So I've done a lot of classic Russian translation. I started doing the classic Japanese translation last year. But a great love of mine throughout life generally has been crime fiction, murder mystery, that sort of stuff. And I've been in touch with my amazing editor at Pushkin Vertigo, Dennis Seaton, who commissioned a lot of the other Seishi Yokomizo works. And we've been talking about my love of it, and he'd acquired the rights for this book, and he very kindly asked me if I'd want to translate it. So of course I jumped to the opportunity when he
Yeah. That's really fantastic. I mean, we love talking about that process here on Death of the Reader, and it's been so interesting getting to hear from people, like we heard from On Namoto recently on the show, thanks to She Done It, and his experience with his grandfather, Seishi Yokomizo, and also what Daniel Seaton had to go through to get all of these books and why it's such an exciting new field. So did you choose to read through this book the whole way in Japanese before starting translating at all? Did you put pen to page right from the start? What's the actual process there for you?
Well, it's interesting. So with this one, I'd actually read the book in Japanese years and years ago. So when Daniel and I were talking about Yokomizo, it was kind of nostalgic, actually, sort of revisiting these books. It's fantastic seeing them coming to English. So yeah, when we agreed to do it, I reread the book, loved it as much as I did the first time around. But yeah, I think it's so important, particularly with crime fiction, detective fiction, that you know exactly what's happening, because you kind of got to know where the author's leading you, where he's misleading you, all that sort of stuff.
I suppose there's a level to it in translation where you'd probably notice a lot more of those little misleading and leading details than you would the first time through the book. Was it a whole new experience reading it specifically for the context of translation?
I think absolutely. I mean, crime fiction, it trains you to be a very specific kind of reader. It's a very active reader. You're constantly on the lookout for all these details, but then when you're doing it as a translation, you're that much more immersed in every single line. You're sort of questioning every inflection, every turn of phrase, every sort of detail that's being given to you, thinking, oh, is this a red herring? Is this a clue? What's happening here? What's the meaning of this? Like, and not just what's being said, but you're also very conscious of what isn't being said.
So what are some of the challenges in carrying across meaning, particularly from Japanese to English, that you think most English readers wouldn't really expect when they're first getting into that sort of thing?
I mean, it's an interesting question. There are a lot of things in translating from Japanese, particularly, that are more challenging in this respect than, say, translating from Russian or from French or German. One of the first ones, the most obvious ones, is the Japanese encodes personal relationships or degrees of formality or informality or intimacy much more overtly into the very grammar of the sentence, really. So when you're translating that into English, you've got to make choices to represent that really in different ways. So for example, in terms of tone, in terms of phrasing, it's much more sort of fluid in that way rather than a very sort of starkly grammatical way of doing it. Other things, one thing that I was particularly conscious of while translating this is how Japanese likes to drop subjects and how it's much more of a gender-neutral language, in that it's very easy to sort of get away with not saying whether you're talking about a man or a woman, whether you're talking about one person or several people. Is very good at hiding that.
Yeah, I can think of many Japanese mystery novels I've read that have played with the quantity and gender of their characters as a key part of the mystery.
Absolutely. But it's interesting because when you're doing, particularly when you're doing like honkaku, Japanese literature, you want to still maintain that element of fair play. You don't want to be deliberately misleading the reader in a way that would be inappropriate for the genre. So you've got to come up with creative ways sometimes of doing that in English in order to get around it. But it's always a huge bit of fun trying to do that. So,
well, I mean, talking about that game of trying to see how you can still play with the readers, do you try and avoid injecting your own voice into translated text, or is that an inevitability that it's better to learn how to accept? What are kind of the habits in your own translation that you've had to beat out of yourself or refine over the years in that regard?
That's a really interesting question. I try as much as possible to sort of beat myself out of it. I see translation a lot of the time as more being sort of ventriloquist's act. So, I mean, when I was a kid, I devoured all sorts of sort of golden age writing, like Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, all of that. So I've kind of got their voices in the back of my head while I'm doing a lot of this, I think. And you sort of, you know the conventions, you know the sort of overall tone that you're going for. So it's trying to create something that will evoke a similar response in an Anglophone reader, I think. I think that's what I'm always trying to do first and foremost. It's got to read like a convincing work of literature, and it's got to be enjoyable in the first respect. So it's interesting when you get this question of fidelity, because I think you can so often be so attached to the words on the page, you kind of forget what the words are supposed to be doing, and that's creating an impression on the reader. So I'm always trying to sort of create the impression first and foremost, rather than sort of looking at the words specifically, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose the other question that comes to mind then is that it's been over 70 years since this book was first published, and a large part of the Honkaku school of Japanese mystery fiction is the cultural emotions at the time in Japan. So is it the language barrier or the time barrier kind of bigger for you as a translator there? Are there some details to that social context that make it difficult to do the translation?
I mean, in some ways, it's the time that's more difficult, or it can be with other authors. But I mean, one great thing about The Village of Eight Graves, is, or just with Yokomizo in general, is the time and the place is so integral to the work itself. I mean, this work, it's certainly immediate post-war years, and the war really looms heavily over absolutely everything that happens. It determines a lot of the characters' destinies and their fates. So you've got to be alive to that. But whereas with some other authors, it might be a bit, the context might be assumed. With Yokomizo, he really integrates it into the storytelling, which makes it so much easier for me as a translator, because you don't have to do all that explaining yourself. You don't have to make any interpolations, because he already sort of works it in a really naturalistic way, which has been just a joy to sort of translate in that respect.
I think the last thing I wanted to touch on before we kind of wrap up today, Brian, is I've not actually read The Village of Eight Graves, because my Japanese is, as the natives would say, Jozu. From what I've heard, The Village of Eight Graves has been incredibly influential in the local Japanese scene, with so many different series, both inside and out of crime fiction, you know, drawing from its setting, its characters, its puzzle. Is there anything that, after taking a more in-depth look into The Village of Eight Graves, you've retroactively realized was inspired by it? Is that influence as big as I've actually heard?
I think so. I mean, it's certainly one of Yokomizo's most enduringly popular works, particularly within the Kindaichi series. I think there are a lot of reasons that could be. I mean, it's got so many different elements to it. Like I was talking about earlier, there's a historical element to it, but there's also a sort of gothic element. There's also the classic element to it. And some of the writing in it, I think, is just so cinematic. There's sort of scenery up in the mountains. There's also sort of passages, sort of secret passages in a series of caves. And it's made it this sort of cultural touchstone almost. So it definitely strikes a chord with Japanese readers. Looking online the other day, sort of at just reading up on exactly this, about how important it is for contemporary Japanese readers, and you sort of see people dressing up as some of the characters for it for Halloween and all these various other things. So I mean, it's become a cultural phenomenon.
It is so exciting to finally be getting more of Kosuke Kindaichi here in English, because after going through the Honjin murder case, for all of the odd little quirks that made me frustrated with that book, it has a warm place in my heart, and I'm so glad to have some wonderful translators like yourself working on that project with Pushkin. So Brian, thank you so much for joining us here on Death of the Reader.
It's been an absolute delight, thank you.
Brian's translation of The Village of Eight Graves joins Pushkin Vertigo's lineup alongside Death Going Down, early this December. We'll have links up on the podcast if you want to get yourself a copy. We are discussing Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down. We'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are discussing chapters 4-6 in our penultimate episode on Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down, our second last book for the year. I'm terrified to find out what Herds has picked for me last at the end of next week. But before we get there, Herds, I hope you are just as terrified to present your solution this week.
I definitely am. There's going to be a lot of rambling today, I think. It's just been so hard to get my thoughts straight on this. let me start with the most obvious point. Okay, let me start with the logical beginning. Soler, okay? I want to talk about him. I'm going to argue that the state of mind that Soler presents to us is meant to give us a glimpse into the mind of our killer today, because he does say that the way for himself to not seem guilty, because he's so self-conscious, is to spare no detail, because obviously people who have nothing to hide would spare no detail. At least he thinks that's how it is. Cleverly hidden through the use of narration rather than actual character lines, which is a telltale sign of of shenaniganry. There is a character in this story who has spared no detail and has been incredibly eager to speak the name of the victim as many times as humanly possible in order to deflect blame. We are going with the oldest trope in the book, my friend. We are going with the husband did it.
Oh, no.
On this edition of Death of the Reader. What if the killer wasn't even in the hotel to begin with? What if they had the perfect alibi, not once but twice, for the various crimes that they're attempting to commit? Can I tell you, the moment where I figured that he was probably the killer...
Let's just be clear. This is Mr. Eidinger.
Yeah. This is why I was worried when you said Gabby. When Betty is presumably tearing up photographs and flushing them down the toilet, screaming, I assume, to hide the sound of the toilet flushing. I hope. That's my theory.
Yep, yep.
And he's talking to her, and the detectives are both there, and he says, you know, I arranged for us all to, like, be here at the same time. Isn't that crazy?
Very convenient.
And she keeps looking to him to tell her what to say. And he's like, yeah, tell them everything. And she's like, oh, I don't know if I should say this. And she looks at him again. He's like, yeah, tell them everything. It's very clear to me that Eidinger is manipulating Betty. That seems like the linchpin of this whole
situation. I can see that a little bit. I can definitely see, you know, because obviously several of the, like, paternal figures in the apartment block in which the elevator is are portrayed very, I guess, old-fashionedly patriarchal.
They're all trying to, like, protect Betty. That's my theory, basically, except for our murderer. Our murderer is a no-good human being, and Serbo deserved to get murdered because he's, like, in on the scheme, whatever the scheme is. We'll get to that. But
I hope we will.
But Lukta, the doctor, and Senor Inara, who flicks his machine off, and possibly, I don't know about Soler, I feel like he's not in on this, but definitely those two, those two very patriarchal figures, are being overprotective.
Yeah, yeah.
Slight confession to make. I have seen the name of the next chapter. It is, let me.
It's a new character. We haven't met him yet.
Well, this is the thing that concerns me.
Who is?
Well, it says where is.
Not where is.
Where is.
Emilio.
Well, it's funny that you said who is. Part of this chapter has come in, you know, immediately after picking up some notebook that's been tossed out. I feel like I need to finger who this character is. I'm going to say, in terms of the why, this is the biggest jab in the dark that I have. I'm going to say that Senor Inara is Emilio Villalba. I think that what's happening here in terms of the actual plot, he's probably, Eidinger is probably extorting Betty for money, possibly money that's supposed to be going to medicine for Senor Inara, Agustin, and that his plan, since Frida was like, I'm going to go over and expose your plan and, like, get Betty out of this. He was like, well, she has to go. And that's what's kicked off this whole situation.
Interesting.
That's where my brain's at. Please poke at it.
I'm still a little unclear on a few things here. I mean, first of all, you know, we've shaped up the general structure of the motivation of this crime, but I'm still a little confused as to the absence of many set pieces that we get through this novel.
Oh, no.
For example, we make a very clear ordeal of Blasi and Ericourt, you know, speaking German to various characters who feel more comfortable speaking in German, mm-hmm. even though they supposedly have Argentinian heritage.
Sure.
We have that entire opening scene with Lucter and Soler, which I completely agree is meant to make them look suspicious as all hell.
Mm.
But at the same time, there's a lot of detail there, like the lipstick rolling away, which is like, you know, classic murder mystery clue number one. Oh no, piece of evidence goes missing.
Mm.
Like, what do you put those down to? Why are they here? Are you saying that they're just willy-nilly red herrings?
No, well, I would say that those characters who are more comfortable speaking German, I forget who they are, but those characters were people that Inara has brought over from Germany. And so all those characters probably in on that, like, let's get people out of Germany because world wars. And that's the information that Mr. Eidinger is holding over, that Gustavo is holding over Betty and the other characters. The lipstick.
But at the same time, if Gustavo's kind of like holding it over them when he has a German wife who is an immigrant herself,
sure.
What's he actually holding over there? Like, oh goodness, you're an immigrant, just like my wife. How horrible.
Yes. Well, I mean, I would assume that the thing that is being held over is not that these characters are German. It's that Inara like did some bad stuff in order to get them over from Germany, that he's like in charge of that, but
smuggled them in through the rum tunnels.
Well, maybe that's. Look, I may not 100% have an answer for all of this. I apologize. this story is tricking me all over the place. There's something that Inara is responsible for. I'm just not sure what 100% what it is. It might be connected to those photos, but I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I guess sure that would point. Be the next clue that I want to poke you on, is that the photos and the engraving appearing in the background of one of them has come up many, many, many times through the story, but I don't know if I've heard any real explanation as to why that's of any concern. You know, sure, it could be a symbol of them being smuggled into the country if we're going to try and like line it up with what you have here. But like, you know, if the police are going to see it and it's compromising information, why is he willing to like track it down to show it to the police?
I mean, probably to deflect him. Isn't that Eidinger? Isn't that Gustavo who's like showing this symbol to people? Maybe that's the big secret. This symbol is like something that binds all these German characters together. They're part of some like, I don't know, nudist cult, let's say. I don't know is the problem. They're probably part of some group, if I had to guess, that like used to be bad news. I don't know.
Now they're trying to leave it behind. This is where I have the biggest issue with your theory here, is that like,
great,
we keep pushing on this like collective idea of this group of people doing things. And first of all, you know, SS Van Dyne doesn't like groups of conspiracy theorists and co-conspirators because criminal organizations kind of downplay the mystery. But whatever, that's SS Van Dyne. We poo on him enough.
Sure.
The problem I more have is I feel like if we were going to be presented with that, we would have had a bit more tangible evidence to
that's why I'm not sure.
Branding.
I need to be clear. Like, I'm not saying that like this group was responsible for everything. I'm saying that like Inara like helped these people. And that he is the one who is like the person with the secret that needs to not come out. And I assume that Emilia was involved in that. I'm not sure what the secret is the problem.
Yeah. You know, you're kind of leaning on the whole idea that it's like some kind of double crime for political revenge of some sort.
I am not as strong with the political murder mystery angle as I would like. So I may just have to let this one go, unfortunately, if what I've said so far is not enough to earn me a point.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Herd, I'm just saying that the obvious solution you should have gone with is that Soler and Lucter were in on it together, and the entire opening scene was an unreliable narrator as they actually just did the crime and chucked the lipstick down the elevator. But I guess you'll just have to wait and find out next week.
I guess we'll see. If it is that simple, then that'll be very unfortunate. But we'll guess we'll find out. Anyway,
I suppose, Herds, we will depart from this week's edition of Death of the Reader in preparation for the final chapters of Death Going Down by Maria Angelica Bosco next week on the show, and the unveiling of our grand finale novel for 2021.
Mm.
Thank you very much for joining me, Herds, and thank you for joining us.
Want to see what I have cooked up for us next time on. Death of the Reader.
It's your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3. We'll see you next.